The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Sheikh Javed, sometimes we don't have such stipulations in the contract.
Yes.
All right? So suppose the author did not specify anything regarding the subsequent editions. Is it permissible for the publisher to reprint the material without the permission of the original author? And what if they don't pay the author?
I think there must be a kind of contract when, for the first time, the author is going to hand over his book or his work to the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
That contract could be verbal; it could be in written form.
Mm-hmm.
So, that contract has to be will specify whether the writer has to be paid or not. In either case, if the contract says that, okay, for the second or the third or fourth edition, the writer, the original writer, will not have to be paid, so they will go ahead according to the contract. And if the contract or the agreement stipulates that the original writer will have the right to be repaid and compensated, then, of course, the two sides will have to comply with that agreement, and the publisher especially cannot violate or cannot break or breach the contract, and cannot contravene, let's say, go against the agreement made or reached between the two parties.
So what if they have forgotten, in fact, to include or incorporate such notes or such provisions in the contract?
If there is a case of, let's say, forgetfulness,
yes,
and they forget, I think Ayatollah Khamenei, as I said, exercises precaution. He says it is a caution to preserve his right and ask his permission for the subsequent, let's say, editions. Okay?
Yes.
The subsequent editions has to be published after obtaining the writer's permission and consent.
Should they, in fact, refer to the law of that specific country then?
If there is a law in place,
yes,
and that law is actually
like a third party, for example, to contract, or, for example, like an arbitrator, like a judge, an external judge who can observe and supervise, for example, such contract and pass judgment over this.
If there's an Islamic country, of course, they can contact the Muslim judge,
yes,
to make a decision or to pass a judgment,
yes,
between the two sides to settle the dispute and come to a solution. Okay.
If it is not a Muslim country,
if that is not, of course, there is a law. The law is not in favor of either the publisher or the writer.
Yes.
The law could be based on some just principles.
Yes.
Okay. And if they accept the law, then these two people can turn to the law and of course decide and follow the law of the country of which they are a national. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion, of course, Ayatollah Khamenei exercises precaution. He says it is a caution to preserve the right. Okay, if the book is published for a second time or for a third time, now this caution is not a fatwa. I think I have been telling it many times,
mm-hmm,
and I have told it. Several times that whenever a mujtahid exercises precaution or in Arabic terminology, ihtiyat, then the duty bound, the mukallaf, has the right to choose to either stay to follow mm-hmm. the according yes. to act according to the precaution, or he can choose to follow the next mujtahid. Mm-hmm. The next mujtahid may have a fatwa or may not have a fatwa. If he has a fatwa, he can follow him. Otherwise, he cannot.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Black Americans are still receiving COVID vaccinations at dramatically lower rates than white Americans, even as the chaotic rollout reaches more people, according to a new KHN analysis. Stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Hannah Rechet and Lauren Weber, journalists. This article is published under the heading Black Americans Are Left Behind as the Vaccine Rollout Expands. Here's the details. Black Americans are still receiving COVID vaccinations at dramatically lower rates than white Americans, even as the chaotic rollout reaches more people, according to a new KHN analysis. Almost 7 weeks into the vaccine rollout, states have expanded eligibility beyond frontline healthcare workers to more of the public, in some states to more older adults, in some others to essential workers such as teachers. But new data shows that vaccination rates for Black Americans have not caught up to those of white Americans. Seven more states published the demographics of residents who have been vaccinated after KHN released an analysis of 16 states 2 weeks ago, bringing the total to 23 states with available data. In all 23 states, data shows white residents are being vaccinated at higher rates than Black residents, often at double the rate or even higher. The disparities haven't significantly changed with an additional 2 weeks of vaccinations. In Florida, for example, 5.5% of white residents had received at least one vaccine dose by January 26, compared with 2% of Black residents. That's about the same ratio as 2 weeks ago, when the rates were 3.1% and 1.1% respectively. African Americans are being left behind because of barriers stemming from structural racism, as well as a failure to address nuance, hesitancy and mistrust about the vaccines and the medical system overall. The ongoing vaccination gap has prompted officials from around the nation to call for action. With COVID-19 continuing to take a disproportionate and deadly toll on communities of color, we need urgent solutions to address health inequities and crush this virus, said Representative Stephen Horsford, first vice chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. He said he is working to pass legislation to address inequity. Across the U.S., non-Hispanic Black Americans are 1.4 times more likely to contract COVID and 2.8 times more likely to die of it than white Americans, according to a Center for Disease Control and Prevention analysis. The ongoing disparity in the vaccinations may be a self-fulfilling prophecy. A new KFF poll shows a correlation between people who now someone who has gotten the vaccine and a willingness to get it. Thus, it is harder to gain ground in communities that don't have many people getting vaccinated. One of President Joe Biden's first executive orders prioritized COVID data collection. He established the COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force led by Dr. Marcella Nunes-Smith, who cited KHN's analysis in a CNN town hall recently when describing the country's vaccine inequity. But Dr. Selling Grounder, a former COVID advisor for Biden, cautioned there is no quick fix to the structural inequities reflected in the numbers, and Congress still needs to decide on Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan. If they fund it in full, you will have the money to do some of these things, Grounder said. What you really need to do is change the system so it doesn't happen in the first place. Earlier this month, the CDC told KHN it planned to add race and ethnicity data to its dashboard, but could not say when. Citing KHN's initial analysis, Senator Elizabeth Warren tweeted on January 19th that the CDC needs to add race and ethnicity data to its public dashboard immediately. We can address what we can see. CDC spokesperson Kristen Norland has recently said officials plan to release the data publicly early next week. Vaccine providers have already been required by the CDC to collect race and Hispanic ethnicity information for each person they vaccinate. In states that refuse KHN requests for the data, local reports suggest disparities can be stark. Many of the states that have shared data by race put it on the dashboards that are difficult to understand. Some report data by dose, meaning that people who have received both doses are represented twice. All 23 states that are reporting data by race break out numbers for Black and white residents. But beyond that, data is often limited. 8 of them do not report specific numbers for Native Americans and Alaska Natives who are dying from COVID at 2.6 times the rate of white Americans, according to the CDC study. Massachusetts, for example, combines all data for people whose race is unknown with Native Americans, Alaska Natives, Native Hawaiians, Pacific Islanders, and others. Race and ethnicity information in healthcare data is often incomplete, and COVID data is no exception. Although most states that provide the data have relatively low rates of missing information, in a few states, race and ethnicity demographics are missing for the half people who have been vaccinated. The data on Hispanic ethnicity is particularly fraught. Those who give vaccines are supposed to ask patients about both race and Hispanic ethnicity in separate questions, because Hispanics can be of any race or combination of races. In nearly all states that break out such numbers separately, The percentage missing Hispanic ethnicity information is far higher than those missing race information. Hispanic Americans have died at far higher rates than non-Hispanic white Americans. The CDC data release should help standardize what data is available, in addition to possibly providing clarity on the dynamics in the 27 remaining states. But it is not yet clear how the CDC will address gaps in data collection.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bahtizi, 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 Ey shaheedon rahe khuda, Ey karde, bahre ehyaye haq jan fada,
the coronavirus pandemic battered the global economy like nothing else has done for decades. Prolonged nationwide lockdowns in some countries and mismanagement of the crisis in others have all contributed to 2020 becoming one of the gloomiest years for the global economy. It's not surprising to learn, according to a new report from the International Labor Organization, that workers around the world have lost $3.7 trillion since the pandemic began. Globally, 8.8% of working hours were lost, and 114 million people experienced employment loss, what the report called an unprecedented level. What's shocking is another report that made headlines. Billionaires around the world, who initially suffered massive losses like everyone else, have seen their wealth increase by $3.9 trillion as the entire globe has been grappling with the impacts of the deadly respiratory disease. That figure, according to the Oxfam report, is enough to vaccinate every single person on Earth against the coronavirus and help them stay out of poverty.
It's a new normal, but I don't think it's a sustainable new normal. So the level of increase in wealth is enormous. And it's already coming not out of the market system now, which is what caused the inequality before the financial crisis. It's now coming out of the impact of government policy. And this is really the ineffectiveness of government policy led by mainstream economists who have no idea of the role of inequality, really, in society. Most of their models talk about a representative agent where they lump together income from wages and income from profits as if we both receive them equally. So that level of naivety lies behind policies that believe we can revive the economies by boosting the wealth of the wealthy.
In the meantime, the workers may have to wait for a decade to be able to recover the losses they sustained. The report also estimates between 200 million to 500 million people may have fallen into poverty during 2020. Oxfam has said in its report that the world's billionaires' collective net worth is now standing at nearly $12 trillion, equivalent to what G20 countries have spent in response to the pandemic. The most vulnerable workers have faced some of the biggest job losses throughout the pandemic's recovery, and that K-shaped trajectory may continue.
This is Ben Bernanke is on record as saying this, thought one way to revive the economy was to increase the value of shares and cause what he calls a wealth effect to encourage more spending and stimulate the economy. And I summarise that as trying to make the economy better by making the wealthy wealthier, because only a tiny fraction of the population owns shares, and that boosted their wealth without touching what happened with the remainder. Now, when COVID has struck, a very similar process is afoot. Central banks are buying bonds again, giving the financial sector large amounts of cash, which they then use to buy shares, which drives up share prices, and that's what's causing what's called the K-shaped recovery. Asset markets, particularly share markets, are skyrocketing, while at the same time, because workers can't go to work due to lockdowns and the impact of COVID, the income of workers is falling.
The International Labour Organization said there were some encouraging signs of recovery at the start of 2021, with the COVID-19 vaccine gradually being deployed around the world. However, it's still estimated the continuing economic fallout would lead to a 3% loss of working hours globally in 2021, compared with the end of 2019, equivalent to 19 million full-time jobs. In a pessimistic scenario, which assumes slow progress on vaccination, working hours would fall by 4.6% this year, while in an optimistic path, the world economy would still lose 1.3% of working hours. The outcome would depend on how well the pandemic was brought under control and by how much consumer and business confidence recovered. A slow vaccine rollout and uneven distribution could also impact the speed at which the global economy recovers. This has led the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to downgrade their respective outlooks. It seems that the only way out of the current economic situation for the governments around the world is aiming for a targeted recovery that prioritizes employment and would provide support for hard-hit workers and sectors.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was the fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. Rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we've seen that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017. When Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey. The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazaar forever, but it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be its citizens of Myanmar. They've been denied that basic fundamental right. It's not the fact that, you know, by history, they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied, and you're absolutely right. That is the heart of the problem. And it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. A UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
The brawl between amateur investors and Wall Street professionals began with hedge funds and big corporations shorting the stock or betting on several small companies' fall of share prices. That captivated people's attention on social media, and in the wake of it, online campaigns led to the buying of the company's stock with aim of pushing up the price. Companies like GameStop were shorted by hedge funds and were labeled as failing by big investors. However, the online movement dramatically soared prices with its stock, trading between $112 and $480 a share. That's up from around $18 a share a few weeks ago. That's while some investors were also hoping to make a quick buck, and others seeking to squeeze the hedge funds. The movement cost hedge funds and other big investors dearly, causing investment platforms such as Robinhood to put a ban on trading stock for GameStop, AMC, BlackBerry Limited, the Nokia Corporation, and several other companies, which resulted in shares to fall by 50%. This ignited protests outside the company's California headquarters and in the Manhattan banking district yesterday. Also, groups of angry protesters gathered in front of New York's stock exchange and chanted, "I want my money, and I want it now." They were also holding up signs which read, "Tax Wall Street and tax the rich." The act of restricting stock trade sparked lawsuits and called for investigations from lawmakers. Consequently, the Robinhood's co-founder, Vlad Tenev, announced that the suspension of trading of the stocks will be lifted, though only a limited amount of shares could be traded under the company's supervision. He also rejected the notion that this act is in favor of the hedge funds. The war between amateur investors and Wall Street has caused mayhem in the US stock market, with professional investors calling stock movements being obviously disconnected from fundamentals. However, how powerful are the big corporations, and can they restrict investors from buying shares and stopping individuals gaining a slice of the cake?
I think what we're seeing is people are extremely frustrated because a subgroup of people on Reddit have been able to game the system of Wall Street in their favor against billion-dollar hedge fund managers, and they're finally seeing a clamoring for regulation all of a sudden on Wall Street now that it's the people at the top that are being affected. For decades, for centuries, the Wall Street fat cats have been able to profit off the misery of others. They've made billions, trillions of dollars. They've gotten bailouts. They've done speculative measures. They've profited off of the misery of others, and yet nothing has happened.
Regulators in the United States have warned that the situation is under their scrutiny following a number of share trading platform suspension of trade stocks of the GameStop company and several other firms. One of these share trading platforms is Robinhood, a company that's been accused of gamifying share trades. Robinhood is also under fire for its decision to suspend trading and has sparked outrage among investors who accuse the firm of working in favor of hedge funds and big Wall Street investors who are losing millions of dollars to an army of novice traders. The anger has now spread beyond the investment community, with US politicians joining the backlash against Wall Street. Democratic Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has called the restriction unacceptable, calling for more details to be published on Robinhood's decision. She also criticized suspending retail investors from purchasing stocks while hedge funds are free to trade as they wished.
The people are upset. People are upset that they have been able to outsmart those on Wall Street and turn a bigger profit for themselves. Some people were able to turn $30,000 into $1 million, etc. They want to continue to be able to do that, and they see this as an attack on the free market. Obviously, the market has never been free, and it continues to be a game that's completely rigged. But I think the defining point is the fact that finally the free market was able somehow to be used to help those who are more at the bottom than more at the top, and obviously you have the free market intervening to prevent this from happening further.
It seems that the online mania to steal from the rich and give to the poor has been betrayed by Robin Hood, who seems to be the real sheriff of Nottingham in this case. However, the fury against control of the system of big corporations and hedge funds has left people with no choice but to unite. But could the army of novice investors win a battle against the Goliath of big corporations and hunt down the real wolves of Wall Street?
The coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific. But the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump has now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
Welcome to the latest under news. It's great to have you with us now. A 79-year-old Siberian grandmother ice skates on frozen Lake Baikal to look after her cows or just to have some fun. Lobosheva Morkhodova has lived alone by the world's oldest and deepest lake since her husband died in 2011. Her daily routine consists of chopping wood and carrying buckets of water from an ice hole, keeping cows and regularly hitting the ice. Lobosheva uses a pair of steel skates made by her father 76 years ago to check on her cows when they walk too far from her house. When asked why she likes skating, the babushka said because her heart longs for it.
I need my skates for various things. I need them to run errands and I need them for fun. To have a skate or to look for my cows. I can ice skate here and there when walking through the snow is hard. I skate to a direction looking for my cows. And when I see they're not there, I skate to another part and find them roaming there. I call them and they return home, just like that. And without chores, when I just want to ice skate, I can do it.
Even the strong winds, unrelenting cold, and constant hard work don't deter Lubozhe Morkhodova, whose name translates as love walking on the sea. Since her husband's death, she has been resisting calls from her family to move back to the city. Lake Baikal is often frozen over for half of the year, and the septuagenarian believes skating on it is the secret to her longevity. Two giant pandas at a zoo in Washington take full advantage of the winter season and have a blast playing in the snow. The animals' pure joy, caught on camera, could melt even the iciest of hearts. In a clip shared by the zoo, the adorable panda bears are seen rolling, sliding, and tumbling around in the snow. The zookeepers say the pair's five-month-old male cub also experienced his first encounter with snow. They say he even took a little nip at the fresh powder. However, he only spent a few minutes outside his indoor habitat. The Smithsonian's National Zoo is currently closed to visitors due to the coronavirus pandemic, but its panda cam is available for all to enjoy. Conservationists have rescued a third giraffe from the flooding island of Lake Baringo off Kenya. The daring rescue was the third such operation since the area was hit with intense rain, threatening the survival of the trapped animals. Two other maroon giraffes were transferred to safety in December. Local rangers say the animals are trained before being moved, so they don't need to tranquilize them. They say six other Rothschild's giraffes are still stranded on the shrinking island.
We still have quite a number, six actually giraffes, including the recent young one which was born in December. This is a process that we are trying to look at a case or day-by-day scenario. The moment we train these remaining giraffes, the moment they are ready, we move them. But
the target is to move these animals. The The rangers say they plan to complete moving all the giraffes to a purpose-built sanctuary on the mainland by no later than May. Today there are fewer than 3,000 Rothschild's giraffes in Africa, with 800 of them living in Kenya. The parade of classic and vintage cars has enlivened the streets of the French capital, Paris. About 700 vehicles of various eras drove through the streets of Paris, passing its landmarks such as the Eiffel Tower. Different vehicles, including cars, buses and motorcycles, took part in the show. It was the 21st edition of the parade that takes place twice a year. The event is the most important one for old car enthusiasts in France.
The sniffing abilities of dogs are being put to the test at a leading French veterinary laboratory where dogs are being trained to detect the coronavirus. Five dogs from the canine brigades of the French National Gendarmerie have been training since early January. They sniff at a number of vessels, each containing a piece of cloth with human sweat. Some samples are from patients with COVID-19, negative donors, or even neutral scents. When the canine shows interest in a vessel with a COVID-19 sample, it is rewarded.
It will soon be necessary to screen asymptomatic people in all kinds of spaces, schools, nursing homes, which must continue to be better understood and defined, and airports. This type of tool, which makes it possible to offer at least one strong criterion of suspicion, will facilitate the whole process in terms of user-friendliness, accessibility, and reactivity.
Well, the dog's keen sense of smell is said to be able to detect the coronavirus in 95% of positive cases. It's hoped that the canines will be able to detect COVID-positive people even if they show no symptoms. The animals can be used as a non-invasive way of testing for the viral infection, as well as many other life-threatening illnesses. Igloo, a dome-shaped structure made of snow and ice, gives us an idea of the Inuit of Arctic. But hang on. The ski resort hotel in Indian-controlled Kashmir has come up with a similar idea to attract visitors. The Kolahoy Green Heights has an igloo cafe where tourists can enjoy hot drinks and food in sub-zero temperatures. Even the tables in the Eskimo-style cafe are made of ice and snow. As many as 16 people can sit and chill out in the igloo at any given time. The icy cafe is 25 feet around. Unlike those on the Arctic, this particular igloo has elements of local architecture, like an arched door and patterns on the curved walls.
A French-Swiss artist spray paints a huge fresco on the grounds of Cape Town as part of a global project aimed at fostering unity in a polarized world. The 31-year-old artist tries to convey his message of togetherness in his movement called Beyond Walls. The project consists of frescoes depicting two hands clasping each other's forearms around the world. South Africa's Cape Town represents an essential step of the project due to its history marked by apartheid. The self-taught artist says he wants to create the biggest human chain in the world, and Cape Town is his ninth step.
Because for me, I really trust that it's only together that humanity can respond to the biggest challenge of our time. And this is this message that I want to do by making huge fresco with beautiful paint directly on the grass. It is a worldwide project, and the idea is to create the biggest human chain to speak about togetherness. And today in Cape Town, this is the ninth step of this project.
Saip uses paint made out of charcoal, chalk, water, and milk proteins to create his art, making it eco-friendly. He was also named one of the most influential young artists by Forbes magazine for his art, which is best viewed from aerial footage. His temporary biodegradable images have been previously painted on lawns in 8 cities, including Paris, Andorra, Geneva, Berlin, Ouagadougou, and Istanbul.
A Russian firm has developed a flying taxi in an attempt to solve the problem of transportation in megacities. According to HoverSurf company, testing the aircraft is now in the final stages. If successful, the drone taxi will go into mass production at the end of 2021. Special runways are not required as the vehicle is as big as a normal car and can land on a parking lot. Designers say it's capable of carrying 2 people or up to 300 kilograms of cargo.
Превратиться в серийный аппарат.
The prototype of this flying machine will soon turn into a social device that we're going to build in 2021, and thus all the technologies that we have already built will be applied to this machine. The car will fly with a new type of engine that is installed here.
The flying taxi can reach an altitude of 150 meters and develop a speed of up to 200 kilometers per hour. The company says a flight with air taxi will cost around 27 cents per kilometer. The name Afghanistan may remind many people across the world of some bad news of war, violence and poverty. This is mainly due to the war in Afghanistan, which has been going on for over the past decades. Yet there are some interesting stories about Afghanistan, its people and their traditions and customs, such as Afghans' food culture. Amin Alami has more in this report.
When it comes to cooking and traditional dishes, Afghans have a lot to say. First of all, this is important to know that meat and rice are inseparable parts of Afghans' food culture.
Afghan traditional dishes like qabili, kebab, karai, mantu, ashak, bulani, and dugh are the some you can find available in restaurants, mainly serving traditional delicacies. Each one of these represents the food culture of specific tribes and ethnic groups.
Let's see what the manager of this restaurant has to say about some popular local dishes in Afghanistan.
When you want to talk about traditional foods of Afghanistan, you need to test different dishes that are, of course, very delicious. For instance, qabili is a mixture of rice, carrot, cuisine, and lamb meat. Northern Afghanistan is a home to this delicious food, while Western Herat province is well known for its delicious khichdi.
There are some key factors which should be taken into consideration when talking about Afghan food culture. As Afghans themselves say, their food is highly organic. They believe the food culture has made Afghans' bodies much stronger than those who do not have organic meals in their food culture.
We can't leave out meat from cooking. Additionally, our food culture is based on using organic products. This has even helped us have a stronger body.
As there is a wide variety of delicious dishes here, the good news is that the prices are not high. For example, you can serve a complete lunch menu at one of the top restaurants in Kabul by spending at most $15.
If you compare food prices in Afghanistan and other countries, you will find out that you can have the best dish in a top restaurant in Afghanistan by paying less than $20. The quality of food in our country is also better.
As observers say, Afghanistan has many capabilities and interesting attractions to be truly introduced for the globe if the war and politics allow this wounded land to breathe. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
That's it for the life. Thank you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ يُو هُ بِلِيهِ اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Brother Khalil Jaafar. He's going to talk about the significance of Lady Fatima's personality.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Bari'il khalaiqi ajma'in. Wassalatu wassalamu ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen. سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد ثم الصلاة والسلام على آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. First and foremost, on this happy occasion, I would like to congratulate all of you and your families on the Wiladat of Sayyida Zahra, Sayyidatun Nisa' al-Alamin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Muhammad, the daughter and the most beloved person to Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The status of this exceptional and great lady is obviously not unknown to us. And I want to share just two things with you and inshallah end. To show you how much knowledge Sayyida had. Because we normally speak of her purity. Of course, in her purity, she's absolutely unmatched. But in her knowledge as well, just to give you an example, and this is something I stumbled on myself by accident, and it just brought this, you know, great realization to how special and how knowledgeable she was. When we speak of knowledge, right? I mean, typically, when we talk of nobility, it's impossible to speak of noble character without bringing in the Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam as you know, representing that. When you speak of loyalty or wafa, you cannot speak about it unless you bring Abul Fadl al-Abbas sallallahu alaihi wasallam, for example. He represents that. When you talk of courage or knowledge or oratory, you bring Imam Ali alayhi salam immediately. You talk of generosity, Imam Hassan, he has to be in that picture. You speak of sacrifice, martyrdom, even before I say the name, you know it's Imam Hussein. He symbolizes it. When you speak of modesty, chastity, purity, you speak of Fatima alayhi salam, right? But look at the issue of knowledge. I found the khutbah, when I read the khutbah of Sayyida alayhi salam after the demise of her father, when she went to Masjid Nabawi and she addressed the Muslims in front of the Caliph Abu Bakr, the words she said to the people, she said, "O Muslims, you are downtrodden, you are lowly people, your neighbors were looking at you like vultures, you drank water from the side, from the gutters, you buried your daughters alive, you married your stepmothers, you had no values, you built idols of stone and wood and you prostrated yourself before that. Allah saved you through my father." This is part of her khutbah. And then she quotes an ayat of Quran. وَكُنْتُمْ عَلَىٰ شَفَا حُفْرَةٍ مِّنَ النَّارِ فَأَنْقَذَكُمْ مِّنْهَا. You were on the brink of the pit of the fire, but he saved you through my father. When was this khutbah given? 11 AH. One day I'm browsing through Nahjul Balagha. Go read Nahjul Balagha, Sermon 26. Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks, he quotes the same words of Fatima. He does not quote this verse of Quran, but he says the same words. "O people, you are lowly, you drank water by the side, you worship idols, you buried your daughters until Allah saved you through Muhammad." When did the Imam Ali give khutbahs after he became the Caliph of the Muslims? 37 AH. So Fatima's khutbah 11 AH, Imam Ali's khutbah 37 at the earliest. The difference is what? 26 years. 26 years later, a man who says saluni, saluni, is quoting and taking and borrowing from Fatima alayhi salam. She cannot be an ordinary person. You cannot say she is emotional. This is knowledge that comes from a source beyond anyone's imagination. She is ma'asuma. Her hadith is binding, is hujjah, is part of Sharia. If she says something, it is like Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq has said it, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said it. So we need to understand this. And then, you know, when it comes to, of course, her purity, and I'm coming to an end here, I just want to share just a few words of poetry in Urdu that are really very nice. And a person, the poet is trying to describe that to talk about Fatima, how difficult it is. He says, "Badro sidra ko sajalun to tera zikr karu. Hadde firdos me aun to tera zikr karu. Abe kausar se nahalun to tera zikr karu. Sar pe Quran uthalun to tera zikr karu. Taje ismat hai tera name girami zahra. Asiya Maryam tujhe deti hai salami zahra." He says, "When I have adorned the heavens, then I dare speak of you. When I reach the uppermost limits of paradise, then I shall dare to take your name. After I wash and bath myself in the water of Kauthar, and I take the Quran on my head, then I dare to take your name. Your first name, and you are introduced by the crown of infallibility. Asiya and Maryam, who are praised for their purity in the Quran, they send their salams on you, O Zahra." I want to end with something that I have said previously. I've actually said it two or three times at different centers sometimes. There may be a few of you who haven't heard this. For those who have heard, it is good to be refreshed, just to show you how special and how blessed we are to be the Shias of Fatima. to be the shears of a personality who says, I will not enter paradise until I take you with me. Okay? She is really some, our enemies know her value. That is why they try and water down her importance. We don't know her value, right? A scholar has explained this in a very beautiful way. He says, look, the Prophet of Islam said that a son is a blessing, is a ni'mah. But a daughter is a mercy, is a rahmah. And on the day of judgment, Allah will question you about his blessings, but not about his mercy. In other words, the Prophet was describing how a daughter is a rahmah. Okay. So this is one hadith. The other hadith of the Prophet is that in the battle of Khandaq, when Imam Ali alayhi salam was going to fight against Amr bin Abd al-Wadd, and there was no one else to fight him, and everything depended on that battle of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the Prophet said, "Baraza al-imanu kullu ala al-kufri kulli." Complete iman has now gone forward to fight against complete kufr. So that's another hadith. The other hadith of the Prophet is that a man's iman is incomplete until he gets married. When he gets married, then his faith is complete. The other hadith of the Prophet ﷺ is that the feet of a mother are jannat for her children. The other hadith of the Prophet ﷺ is Al-Hasan wal-Husayn Sayyidi Shababi Ahlil Jannah. The ayat of Quran is that, O Rasul, we have sent you وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَاكَ إِلَّا رَحْمَةً لِلْعَالَمِينَ. We have sent you as a mercy for alameen. Now bring all this together and see Fatima in this light. A daughter is rahmah for the father. The Prophet is rahmatun lil alameen. Fatima is rahmah for rahmatun lil alameen. Ali is complete iman. But a man's iman is completed when he gets married. Fatima completes the iman of kul iman. And Hassan and Hussein are sayyidah shababi ahlil jannah. But Fatima's feet are jannah for Hassan and Hussein. How then do you describe a lady who is rahmah for rahmatul lil alameen, who completes the iman of kul iman, whose feet is jannah for sayyidah shababi ahlil jannah? We pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on this blessed night. Oh Allah, we ask you for the sake of Fatima al-Batul al-Zahra sayyidatun nisa'i al-alameen. Oh Allah, forgive us our sins this night. We ask Allah to grant us the شفاء of Zahra alayhi salam يوم القيامة ربنا تقبل منا إنك أنت السميع العليم.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم علي حالي حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
IRIB English Radio.